This is the Pedestrian Podcast.
I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We're going to go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
The official podcast of the UK Seahawkers. Here are your hosts, Stuart Court.
Le'Veon Bell wants to be paid as an offensive weapon, when if you're the Steelers, he's come across as a bit of a weapon himself in different ways.
And Adam Nathan.
It's tricky because Hugh Jackson said nothing for me to shove him in.
We are going to follow you. You lead us, okay? Like I told you before, you lead us to darkness, we will follow you.
Go Hawks.
Welcome to another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast, still the one, only, unofficial UK Seahawkers podcast. Myself, Stuart Court, is, as ever, joined by Mr. Adam Nathan, the man who just revealed that he once ran, was it a 20-second 200, 15-second 200 metres when he was...
It was 12-second 200 metres, it was a 4.5-second 100 metres. It just wasn't officially on the clock. So that's why like me and Usain haven't got together and discussed the record. But apart from that, it's I think what we call that is that's Donald Trump timings.
It's a creative license.
Yeah, it's the Fox News time system.
Oh my God, might not go down well with some. So obviously we've got loads to get into this week. We are joined by a pretty small, cool, special guest, and then we'll look briefly into what has happened in the land of the Seahawks since we last convened. Before we go into last week's game, though, and all the Seahawks news, as I said, which has broke since we last recorded, a bit of news that has broke earlier this week. The Seahawks, with delays and safety concerns, I think, will now play the Oakland Raiders in London at Wembley Stadium, the National Stadium for the England soccer football team, on the 14th of October. Still, that hasn't changed. But it's just been a complete cluster, hasn't it?
A little bit. I mean, they obviously gave Spurs as much time as they wanted and needed to get the stadium built. And obviously, I'm fiendishly biased being a diehard Spurs fan. And I'm gutted because it was a really great opportunity to see my two favourite sports teams play, you know, in the same location kind of thing. So I'm upset about that. But, you know, there were always going to be ticketing concerns. And now, hopefully, the number of extra tickets on sale, with Wembley being 90,000 versus 62,000 at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, is obviously a good thing for the fans in the UK that want to go. So a bit of a ball ache, but hopefully in a couple of weeks' time, when the tickets go on sale, all of the stress of the last 6 months trying to get tickets organised should be well in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, it is. It's 8 weeks before the game. We still don't know what part of the stadium we're sitting. It's not. I mean, I was looking forward to going to the new Spurs stadium, because as a Coventry fan, I'm not going to get many opportunities in the next few years. It's just Wembley's just a bit meh, isn't it?
It's just a crap stadium. That's the problem. my friend is a journalist, and he summed it up perfectly, talking about Spurs playing there for a few more games. It's a venue. It's not a stadium. The thing I was most excited about was the atmosphere that could be created at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, as opposed to Wembley, which is just a complete atmosphere and emotion vacuum. Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah. Ticket info is coming out. If you one of those who picked up hospitality tickets, a refund is imminent from Spurs, and then you have to you're near the front of the queue for Wembley tickets. I think that's happening in the next couple of weeks. So keep our eye on all social platforms for the chapter, and obviously NFL UK and Wembley Stadium, I'd imagine, for all the info. The best of British to those who want a ticket, and we'll be trying when the general melee happens in a few weeks. Now to some news. The biggest news, really, from Seahawks that's happened since we last convened was that left tackle Dwayne Brown, who came over obviously in a trade last week seven of last year, from the Houston Texans, signed a 3-year extension with the team worth $34.5 million, which will pay him $16 million in guarantees. Brown earned $8 million signing bonus, and all his 2018 salary is guaranteed. It was a deal which was always seemed to be coming at some point this offseason or this season. and it's good that it's been wrapped up so easily and compared to other deals which may or not be coming for Seahawks. It's been drama-free for Dwayne Brown in this deal, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, John Schneider made it really clear at the draft that this was a deal that was going to sort of get down as a priority. And I think we mentioned this in the first podcast of the season when we compared how Schneider spoke about this deal versus Earl Thomas. So I think it was inevitable. And I have to say, I think it's worked out fairly team-friendly, to be honest.
Yeah. Dwayne Brown's 32, so he's got another four-year contract, I think. I think he's got another 4 years. So he's going to be 36.
Was it an extension or a new deal?
It says three-year extension on the website I'm reading here. So
that should be he plays this year and then has 3 years after that.
Yeah, so which means this deal will take him to 36. This is, I mean, I haven't got the details of it up, but this is kind of what the Rams did with Andrew Whitworth 15 months ago, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this might be complete bollocks, but it would strike me that the left tackle position is sort of as much about your cerebral ability as it is your physical ability, and sort of knowing where to put your body is as important as you know, the physical, you know, it's not like being a guard when you're rushing, you need to smash through someone. The know-how about what to do makes it seem like the left tackle is a position where you might be able to play a little bit older than conventional wisdom would say for that money. So by all accounts, it seemed like a pretty good deal for everyone. And, you know, he didn't light it up last year, I wouldn't suggest. But there are obviously issues with Tom Cable and whatever that hopefully having Mike Solari now will make a difference, and he'll prove well worth that contract.
Yeah, in 2018, he gets the salary cap. He counts $8.25 million, and he is the 18th highest salary cap value of all left tackles. It's you'd be hard pushed to name 17 better left tackles on over the last few years than Dwayne Brown, though, weren't you, in the league?
Yeah, I mean, he's been...
I mean, some of these names are... Oof.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine when the Seahawks get into free agency at some point, we'll probably sign six of them, just, you know, just for the sake of it. Going by the Luke Jokel system. I mean, ultimately, it's no coincidence that these named guys, you know, on the offensive line, in general, you know, play up to their contract and more.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of the deal. I'm a big fan that we've seemingly locked up that side of the O line, and we actually know who's going to be playing that position for the next couple of years. Obviously, touch wood, like, health permitting as well.
As we've said for a long time, like, all we really want to see on that line is continuity, and you would hope that continuity will lead to improvement. So at least if you've got an anchor at center, an anchor at left tackle, at least that's two positions that, you know, we're pretty certain will be there playing at a high level for a while. Whereas, you know, how many off seasons have we gone into the last, you know, 5 or 6 years and said, who the hell's going to play on the offensive line this year?
Yeah, exactly. Well, pretty much, you could probably even go as far back to saying since Walter Jones retired in 2009, I think he retired. Yeah, 2014 Hall of Fame. Yeah, 2009. And I mean, that's nigh on a decade of, uncertainty at what a lot of people put as one of the more important positions in the league, in a team, when you're building a team. It's something, as we said with Andrew Whitworth, that the Rams noticed and made an effort to solve, and it paid off for them in spades last year with the season Todd Gurley had. So you'd hope that the same benefit we'll see at the Seahawks well over the next 2, 3, or 4 years with Dwayne Brown. Also on the O-line, the Seahawks did also add, they do say, you should never go back, but J.R. Sweezy has come back. He signed a one-year, $1.5 million contract with the Seahawks. Sweezy did receive a $100,000 signing bonus, but $600,000 of his contract is tied to him being on the roster in a month's time. Does this say more that for Sweezy, or does it say less for DJ Fluka? Although he did look quite not good, but okay against the Colts last week.
Well, the knock on Fluka has been the pass blocking. You know, the running blocking, you know, he's clearly exceptional at that level, but it's the pass blocking that people seem to have their question marks on, and that there does seem to be, you know, the odd health issue. I think Sweezy is one of those guys where, you know, what the hell do we know about offensive line play, being two English guys that have never played the game and just sort of watch what we watch, and, you know, we think we pick up the information that we get. But I would hope that with the addition of Solari, that's going to make a huge difference. But, you know, Sweezy was never someone that I was gutted to lose. Mm-hmm. But I'm sort of hoping that the change in coach is going to make, you know, a much better player from him than what we saw in the last maybe 2 years of his time in Seattle when he was, you know, at best fine.
Yeah. And also in Tampa Bay, which is where he went a couple of years ago and spent the last couple of seasons, he did look passable, I think we should say. He did look better than he did for most of his time in Seattle. But obviously, Sweezy was a seventh round draft pick and was a defensive lineman in NC State. Any other signatures or lack of that you want to, that caught your eye in Seahawks last few weeks?
Not especially. I mean, they signed a linebacker today, Walden, who I guess is just like a.
So, Eric, if anyone listened to the Colts preview podcast from last year, Ollie, who come on then, he once got called out by Eric Walden on on Twitter as a crab cake lameo or LMAO. I'm not too sure what Walden was trying. So the first thing I did when I saw that news about 20 minutes ago was message Ollie saying we've signed your crab cake. So yeah, he had a decent season for the Colts last year. But yeah, it's just a pretty nothing signing, a pretty nothing time of year building up. Obviously, there's been the common thread of the Seahawks training camp has been injuries before today, really. The most notable one was the absence of Doug Baldwin, who has, is it a knee ailment he has, Adam?
Yeah, I think it is. And let's be honest, missing Baldwin for any period of time would be an unmitigated disaster.
Yeah, there's not a lot. And obviously, there's a massive scare earlier on today that when Tyler Lockett went down, and according to Michael Sean Dugar, the whole team ran to his aid, but apparently just been stepped on the calf and he seems to be fine. But Doug Ball with a knee ailment, he's going to miss all the preseason. It doesn't sound like he's a complete nailed on certainty for week one against Denver, but as you say, we have to get him out there in some shape or form as much and as quickly as we can, don't we?
Yeah, we're missing the whole of preseason. The Browns would be gutted to see a player do something like that. more on that later. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, that guy missing the whole of preseason is about as relevant as me missing the whole of preseason. It's going to make about as much of a difference to the franchise. He shouldn't be out there in the first place. It's a nonsense, really, the whole 4 weeks of games. And as long as he's back and out there for week one, that's fine by me.
Yeah, also missing all the preseason is Deion Jordan. Last time we did a podcast, we spoke about his importance. And then obviously he has a stress issue in his shin or his leg somewhere, which is one sounds really painful and we're really quite worrying, but he needs to get on the field because, as you said on the last podcast, he hasn't really shown that he can stay on the field when he gets on the field.
He almost looks like a guy that's like too big for a human being. Yeah. Like he's the next level of evolution and the human race hasn't quite caught up with how you can be that big and that strong, like in a human body, because he is an Adonis of a man. But I just wonder if he's just sort of too big and he can't avoid injury. And I feel terrible for the guy because what an opportunity, probably going in as a starting defensive end for the team this year. But he's just a complete sick note, and you know, it's just a real shame. And the worry is that the team have put quite a lot of pressure on him to say, oh no, we're counting on him, and you know, he could be our starting defensive tackle. As we said about, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, the guy's just got to get healthy and get on the field, and then we can start talking about production.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's mainly the main thing. Obviously, also with injuries, talking about sick notes. Today at Seahawks training camp, only Chris Carson and CJ Procise were dressed on the field for the running back position. So when CJ Procise is one of the only ones, you know, it's a pretty dire straits on the injury front. That was caused mainly by the fact that Rashard Penny, the first round pick this year, broke his pinky finger in a surgery, which Pete Carroll described as going beautifully. I've never had any surgeries, I don't think. Surgery and beautiful isn't often in the same sentence or in the same stratosphere, Adam.
All I'll say is if I ever do have to have surgery, I pray to God it'll be a beautiful one.
Yeah, I mean, what does that even look like? A pinky finger surgery does not sound like, one, something I want to live through, or two.
Do you know what it is with Pete? You know how, like, on transfer deadline day, you get the create your transfer with the your date of birth is the fee and the month that you're born in is the reason and the year you're born in. I feel that like Pete sort of has like a generator of terms. So like maybe because it was a Wednesday, beautiful coming up in the term.
I
kind of feel that's how it goes for him, because some of the language that he used to describe stuff is, I mean, I saw you have a conversation with Mike Duggar, like it's just beyond comprehension.
I mean, I really want to see that list of, I think like Barnes and Noble should give Michael a book deal for that series of books that you could just get from his vocabulary.
It's a job for Gordon Curry, I think. He should mock us something up.
It's incredible. Obviously, another thing on injuries, Jamarco Jones last week, I think it was in sometime in the fourth quarter where it kind of just turned into a bit of a nonsense, that game against the Colts, was rolled up on, and one word which always sends shivers down spines of Seahawks fans, he called it a legit ankle sprain, and it appears that injured reserve, or designated injured reserve, or whatever it's called this season, appears likely for Jamarco Jones, who possibly, outside of Shaquem Griffin, was, for other reasons, was my favourite pick of the entire 2018 NFL draft for the Seahawks. But that just really does question the tackle depth on the right-hand side, because it seems that George Fant is going to be cross-trained at that side, and obviously Jermaine Fedi's got all these question marks, and then we've got someone called Isaiah Battle, who I think also got injured last week. It's that depth, even, 10 days or so into training camp, is thin, razor thin, isn't it, at the right tackle spot?
Yeah, I mean, as much as I would like to think they could have done it, it's probably unlikely they were going to start a rookie at right tackle, I would think, especially like against Denver and all the problems they're going to cause. But again, you probably need to see what Solari is going to be like with the line, but I find it very hard to look at Efedi and see an actual starting talent player there.
Yeah.
So it would have been really nice to have an option. I'm always of the view that if something's not working, irrespective of whether there's immediately something that jumps off the page as a replacement, you shouldn't stick with a thing that isn't working. So I would have been, if it was a case of giving Efedi reps to mess up, or giving Jones reps to mess up and maybe improve, I'd have obviously done the latter. So that's a shame. George Fant is obviously the real wild card in the situation. You don't know how he's going to be able to transfer. But
and also, he didn't look very, he looked like he was still within himself. I guess, obviously, it's not even a year removed from his knee just exploding, so he's still not fully there, and that's a dangerous thing to have, a position where the starter is even himself and not in the good graces of many of the coaches, it appears.
Well, I guess in the same way that Lockett probably lost his mind when he thought he got injured today, the mental side of getting over an injury like that is probably as much as the physical side. I mean, look at Earl Thomas. You could argue that his entire holdout is based on the mental scarring of his injury.
Yeah.
And so I guess, I think we said, 2 years ago that Jimmy Graham needs to get a whack on his knee and then he might be a lot better. And I think that's how it proved.
Yeah.
It might be the same with someone like Fant getting over that injury. He probably needs to take a whack somewhere to realize that he's much more stable than maybe he thinks he is.
Yeah. And that's something we saw last week in the Colts game where I think Bobby Wagner destroyed Andrew Luck, and Andrew Luck stood up, high-fived his O-lineman with a massive smile on his face. That's what
you
it
need
was.
It.
That's what it was. That was that. Where I'm back in this now. Like mentally, as much as anything. Obviously, he was there physically, but obviously, I mentally checked back in after that hit. One thing on Rashad Penny. I don't know if you saw this last night. Alistair Gold, who's a really good follow on Twitter, just really cool stuff on field goals. He said that the Penny injury is a bit of a worry because it's free hits on pass protection, and it's the biggest question mark against Rashad Penny. I mean, that's an interesting take, and it could be something that's viable, because I think a couple of years ago we saw with Jermaine Ifedi when he got injured in preseason, it kind of waylaid that entire rookie year, but it may have not, because it didn't really improve last year either. But just you put any weight behind that these free hits he's going to get in preseason, when if he whiffs, as long as Wilson does get injured, doesn't really matter in the grand scheme, is something he's now going to miss out on because he's broke his finger?
Well, the funny thing is that Carroll and Schneider, when he was drafted, Rashad Penny, they were sort of lauding the fact that the analytics guy said how durable he is in college against injury. And then, minute one of the preseason, he goes and does something like this, which is just really frustrating. He's another pick that I guess is, we're just going to have to see how it plays out. It's not the pick I would have made by any stretch of the imagination, but they've done it now. And unfortunately, this stuff, especially when you've got Chris Carson, who by all accounts is tearing it up in camp and looks just ridiculous. Looks unbelievable.
Yeah.
You just really, you know, in a way, Penny has the extra scrutiny, but in a way you sort of want him to do it more because you'd just be so upset for the team and the player if it doesn't work out.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously, I'll quickly run through last week's game against the Colts. So Adam probably made the smart business decision of not watching the game. So what I took from it was the O-line was better with Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson looked really sharp, looked a bit different as well. Run game with Chris Carson and Rashad Penny looked like it had some life. The defense was the defense. The biggest name to come out, the biggest headline from that, though, probably was the emergence of Jacob Martin, I think was a 6th or 7th round pick this year, but also 3rd round pick from USC, Rasheem Green, who's still only 21. We kind of didn't know really what to expect from him last time we did a podcast. But 1.5 sacks, he was a continuous disruption in the Indianapolis backfield. He's going to need to continue to be on the up curve with that, isn't he, over the next few weeks, obviously into the regular season?
Yeah, I mean, our worry from the start was that he might be a bit too small to sort of make an impact straight away, but having seen some of the tackles and the sacks that he made, it's almost like that he was sort of slippery enough to get behind the offensive line versus if they were playing like a regular, in inverted commas, size defensive lineman. He looked really sharp and nippy.
Yeah.
In the way he was beating his blocks.
Yeah, he looked a lot like Michael Bennett did in the.
I mean, I have seen some of the game. I've not just invented that quote. I have seen all the important bits.
Green did how he used his hands, how he got off blocks was very Michael Bennett, and I think they also did like a Michael Bennett line him up, and he got some success against their interior guys as well. Shaquem Griffin obviously was someone who probably got more attention than most Seahawks did last week. His first 4 players in the field, he made 4 tackles. He just seems to know where the ball is. But he's going to be someone who's going to need to continue to do that while adding other things to his game, isn't he?
I'm a bit worried he might be this year's Kayson Williams.
Yeah.
And it would be just... At this point, you have to sort of almost put his disability to one side, because he would want us to do that, I think. Yeah. He wouldn't want to be seen as the guy that's got the problem. But as a result of the problem, that you are extra rooting for this guy to succeed, because it would be such a great story. And I just wonder if he's going to be the same guy that has that unbelievable preseason, all the fans see him as a lock and desperate for him to make it, but he ends up not making it because of limitations that, you know, the guys that know more about the game than us see. I pray that's not going to be the case, but
yeah.
I'm not getting excited by it just yet, because for me, the announcement of him making the team is when I'm going to really buzzing for him, because I've seen this story before with the Seahawks, and I'm just a little bit concerned.
Yeah, and also signed Eric Walden, who sort of plays the same position as him, is raised eyes emoji. Backup quarterback seems to be, well, for me, it doesn't seem to be much of a conversation. I think Mr. Magoo, also my favourite thing of that entire game last week, was the fact his name is actually pronounced Magoo. That made me laugh at 4 o'clock in the morning, whatever time it was. it's just the best. But it seems the one... Mr. Magoo looked the part. I mean, he wasn't sharpest, but his first NFL game. Austin Davis threw a terrible interception and just looked like Austin Davis. Obviously, we don't see him day to day. Maybe we should talk to Michael Shawn or John Boyle or anyone who's there at VMAC every day. But it seems to be that Mr. Magoo is on the outside looking in 2 weeks into training camp, Adam.
Well, for Austin Davis as a quarterback, sort of read Efedi at right tackle, I don't see the point of wasting reps on a guy that can't do it, and we know he can't do it. Now, to caveat again, Colin Kaepernick should obviously be the backup quarterback on this team, and it's ridiculous that he isn't.
Yeah.
But ultimately, if Wilson goes down, we're utterly humped with Austin Davis, utterly. So we might as well see if we're only one utterly humped with Mr. Magoo, the quarterback. Do you know what I mean? You know, what's the difference between 2-14 and 1-15 if that's the case?
Exactly. I did take some notes for the game last week. I think 3 times I went, ugh, Davis. I mean, that was just he just inspires absolutely nothing against scrubs. The Colts defense isn't that good, but it's the starters. At the moment, it's the backup, so it's just I obviously we don't see it every day, so we'll see what happens. Looking ahead, week two, is it the Chargers they're playing again? I think it is, mm-hmm. in Los Angeles. It's just a case of staying healthy, isn't it? Is there anyone you want to kind of see continue or step up that you didn't see anything from them?
I think, as you say, players like Green and Griffin, it'd be nice to see that they're not a one-trick, you know, one-hit wonder. And I do think it would be nice to see the offensive line look fluid again on the opening drive if they do happen to play like they did last week. But, you know, as Field Goals points out fairly regularly, the Seahawks led the league in preseason offense last year and were then a complete car crash for the majority of the season. So it's tricky to read into too much about that going forward, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Obviously, the Chargers have a weird knack of just everyone's ACLs tearing and exploding at this time of year as well. So it's just weird how that continues to happen. Moving on. Probably the reason most people are listening to this week's podcast. It's time to hear from our this week's special guest.
All right, this is Michael Sean Dugar, and you're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast.
So, before we go any further, this is our chat with this week's guest. As you probably saw on Twitter and Facebook, we were lucky enough to get a positive response. We're able to book and get former Seahawk and Super Bowl champ Michael Robinson onto this week's podcast. When Michael Robinson joined the show, when we spoke to him earlier in the week, he said he only had 10 minutes. We actually managed to get a 30-minute chat with him, which was a lot of fun. In this conversation, he does cover a lot of things, including what he was up to while we were talking to him, which is down in Richmond, Virginia, on the east coast of America. He also talked about when he knew when Super Bowl 48 was won. Here is our chat with Michael Robinson. So here on the Pedestrian Podcast, we do try and treat our listeners every now and then. This week is one such of those occasions. Instead of hearing us groan on about the Seahawks, we've managed to get a guest to bring a bit of some gravitas to proceedings. Not just any guest, a former Big Ten champ with Penn State, a semi-finalist in 2005 for the Davey O'Brien Award, a man who came fifth in the 2005 Heisman voting before being a fourth-round NFL draft pick, and of course, a Super Bowl champion. Michael Robinson, how are you, sir?
Doing great, man. Doing great, man. Glad to be a part of the show.
No, we massively, massively appreciate. We appreciate how busy you are going coast to coast and all your media responsibilities. Adam, any questions for Mike?
So I'm going to start off in the college days. So I was listening to the Dave Damashek football program, and he had Cliff Averill on. And Cliff was asked, who was the hardest quarterback he's ever faced to bring down? And unbelievably, well, maybe not unbelievably, he mentioned a Penn State quarterback, Mike Robinson. So apparently you were a bit of a quarterback in your day as well.
Yeah, man. Yeah, quarterback was my first love. I always had natural leadership. I had a little league coach a long time ago told me to be wary of what I say around a lot of people, because when I talk, people listen. And seriously, man, it was one of those things that I knew right then and there that I had some leadership ability. So quarterback was kind of always my spot. But I think I came along probably 10 to 15 years too early.
You'd be killing it now.
In today's draft, yeah, I would have been a maybe first, maybe second round pick. So, but it's all good, though. It's all good.
So at Penn State, obviously, my college fan, I'm sort of caught the back end of it. What was working and playing in the Joe Paterno like, as someone who's on like the Mount Rushmore of college coaches? What was that experience for you like?
Oh, man, it was amazing. It was amazing. I mean, I was fortunate enough to be one of the captains of the team for, you know, 3 seasons. Out of the 5 years that I was there, I was fortunate enough to be a quarterback under his tutelage. I was fortunate enough to have a friend, a father figure, and a mentor going beyond my days on the football field. I mean, he's just a guy that I've always admired. And playing for him, it was a lot of pressure, quite honestly, because you always had his history and the fact that he coached all these great teams and these great young men. You always had that stuff kind of in the background. And when I was there early on in my career, we did well toward the middle. We kind of tailed off, and then toward the end, we got good again. And, you know, our fans still filled the stadium to see Joe, to see the team, even though we were losing. And, you know, he forced me and allowed me to grow and to think about things outside of football. There were so many things more important to Joe than football. That's why, they, you know, for his career to end the way that it ended, with the scandal, with the Jerry Sandusky stuff and all of those things, when all he wanted was the truth to come out, is really unfortunate.
Going from one sort of hugely influential figure to another, I know we're a bit pushed for time, so we'll skip straight to the NFL.
That's okay.
24, Marshawn, for me, in my opinion, you might disagree, I think he might be the most significant ever Seahawk in terms of the attitude that he brought. And for me, he changed the whole franchise and made us, you know, he was a dog and he's someone that we really needed. Obviously, you were a good friend of his when you were with the team, and I'm sure you still are now. What is he like as a guy? I mean, is it what you see is what you get? But he just seems like the most amazing guy.
Well, first of all, he's my brother. You know, he's like my he's my one of my best friends. We talk about everything, anything. But to me, I'm really into spirituality, and I'm not a religious guy. I think religion separates us. I think spirituality brings us all together. And me and him talk about this stuff a lot. He, you know, and I hate to use this word because of the contemporary way we look at it. But I've always told him, he is a walking God. He is how we should be. Why? Because what he thinks becomes reality. And he walks to the beat of his own drum. How much freedom and liberation is that, to be able to have an idea, see it through, and it becomes successful and you don't care what anybody thinks of it? I mean, I was part of the media when the year after my Super Bowl, we won it at the end of the 2013 season. And then they went back again at the end of the 2014 season. And I was fortunate enough to be a part of Media Day and all of those things. And I was also fortunate enough to, you know, be on conference calls and try to, you know, figure out how Marshawn was going to operate Media Day. And, you know, we kind of figured out what he was going to say. And, you know, I talked to his people, and him and I had a lot of conversations. And he said what he said, you know, I'm only here so I don't get fined, boss, and all of those types of things to the media. And then he jumped in his Sprinter, and I was one of the people that jumped in with him with some more family and friends. And he literally, I sat here and I watched and I counted like 25 interviews on his beat, on his way. And he answered every question. He was very outright. He was very revealing. He was very candid. But nobody covers that stuff. You know what I mean? And again, man, I'm telling you, he's that guy.
So to stick with Super Bowl 49, it's funny. You probably saw him interviewed with Matt Barnes a couple of weeks ago. And it was amazing hearing him talk about the play that ultimately is going to transcend the franchise until we win another one. You know, second and goal from the one. But he's the first player I've heard speak about it that genuinely seems to have inner peace about the whole situation.
Well, he can have inner peace, right? Because, I mean, he had no expectations to begin. One thing I love about him, man, he don't expect anything out of anybody. He gives you the energy you give back to him, you know? And, you know, he just kind of walked off the field and, you know, he's told me that story before. I saw that interview. There's also things that I can't say about what happened in the locker room afterwards with the team. But, man, it was a great interview. But, yeah, man, Marshawn, man, he does his thing. He walks by the beat of his own drum. And I think it's something that we all should kind of look at and try to mimic.
Well, it says a lot to me about his humility, because ultimately a lot of other players that I'm sure you know have been with him in the past want to be the guy that, you know, is on the posters and is the story. But he's the humility he's shown to publicly go crazy about that when – the general thinking was that he could have been the guy to bring the second Super Bowl home. You know, that shows an awful lot of character on his part.
Well, yeah. And it's funny that, you know, you guys aren't American media and you notice it. I haven't heard a story about the humility or the character of Marshawn being, you know, all engulfing and all encompassing and having compassion for everybody and all those types of things. You know what I mean? It's crazy that media sometimes outside of our country realizes those things about our players more than our media does.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's more than welcome to come on and talk to us if you want to give him a, you know,
If I talk to him about it, he would probably love to come on you guys' podcast. He does this type of stuff.
That'd be awesome.
We'll do 3 a.m., 4 a.m., whatever time he wants.
Yeah, it'll probably be after the bar one night, you know, just kind of hanging out.
So also with that 2013 team, 2012, you were the person who caught the first Russell Wilson playoff touchdown. throw against Washington. In that 2012 season, something always sticks with me is I think an interview you did, or maybe one of your Real Rob Report videos, when you called Russell Wilson a bad man. How quickly did it take you and the rest of the guys in that building to realise what you had at that quarterback and what was working with him like? And obviously, fast forward to when you saw him a few weeks ago at camp, has there been a change in him over the 7-8 years since?
Well, yeah, man, it's definitely been a change, but it's a natural change, right? Yeah. You know, you go from being a third round, rookie quarterback, stepping, short rookie quarterback that nobody expects anything from, and you come in, get the starting job. You go to a couple of Super Bowls, you're a couple of plays away from a third, and, things are different. And you're obviously a millionaire now, so things are different.
Yeah.
I think for me, Russell's from Richmond, Virginia. I'm actually out here in Richmond, Virginia now. I'm at my son's youth football practice. I run and operate a youth football league, one of the largest youth football leagues in the state of Virginia, Excel to Excellence Youth Football. And I remember Russell coming up to me, or I being introduced to Russell after a state championship game that I played in 1999, I think.
Oh, wow.
And he was in the seventh grade at the time. And, lo and behold, we never knew that our paths would cross again in minicamp of 2012, his rookie season. And I remember getting a call from our general manager, John Snyder, because I was a team leader. And he called me and said, "Hey, man, I know we paid all this money to Matt Flynn, but we're really thinking about playing the rook." I had seen his work ethic. We had seen this guy come in, lead every drill, all of those things. But he was a little bit behind as far as passing the football, because Matt Flynn had just had more experience.
Yeah.
But you could see the determination of Russell. You can see the innate ability to get away from certain pressures. You can see the running ability, all of the things that we see now on display. And, Snyder said, "Hey, man, I think I'm going to do this." And, what do you think about the locker room? And I said, "I know at first it'll be a little kickback, but if he's our guy, he's our guy." He's a VA guy, so my opinion is a little skewed. You know what I mean? I want him to go. I want him to play. And we lost our home opener, man. We lost to Arizona, and the team on the plane, on the ride back, the team was kind of split. And I remember hearing the conversations, and I know Russell could hear the conversations, but I remember us getting off the plane, and he looked at me and said, "Mike, we're not going to have too many of these days. Don't worry. We're not going to have too many of these days." And lo and behold, we go on to the playoffs, and we lose to Atlanta by 27 seconds. But the day that I knew he was the guy was probably the Chicago game of that season. Mm-hmm. He led us back, led us back from being behind, all of those things, hit Sidney Rice in the touchdown, and hit Sidney Rice for a touchdown in overtime. To me, that game kind of epitomized who he is. We weren't expected to win that game. We weren't expected to be in that game, but we won, it was awesome to see.
I remember watching that game and running around my apartment. And funny, because I was going to ask you what was the moment you thought, because I was at the game against Minnesota, I think 3 or 4 weeks before, when he had his real first breakout game at home. And it was just, I think at that point, all the fans around me were thinking, okay, there, this guy's got something. When it comes to being a player that, he wasn't a first round draft pick, or, neither was Sherman, and, so many players in the team that are heralded from a lower draft pick. At what point is it in practice, or is it in a game with players where you as a more senior guy look around and think, okay, this guy's got something, or is it just completely different for every player?
Well, it's different for every player, but for me, I can see it in practice, and that just gives me hope. But when I see it in the game, it gives me conviction about you. And for me, it was really that Chicago game where I said, okay, all right. Well, if this kid continues to mature, continues to get his confidence together, make these passes that he made today, and we can run the football with authority, our defense is at a championship level. It's just about how many of these things can we win before, ego. Now, I don't mean to say ego, but before people having to be paid kind of messes this thing up. So we kind of figured that it was going to happen.
Did you sort of need Atlanta to happen for the following year to happen?
No, I don't think so. I think it helped some, but I don't think we needed it to happen. What I do know is if we could have came out of Atlanta with a win, we had just beat the 49ers by, 40 points. the week before, we were averaging 50 points a game going into, the last 4 or 5 games of the season. And I remember calling Navarro Bowman and Patrick Willis on the bus after we had lost. And, they were, saying we, kind of, talking a little trash or whatever, but they didn't want to play us. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of knew, I kind of figured, man, if we could have got out of Atlanta, we may have, you know, been in line for that first Super Bowl, his Russell's rookie year in 2012.
Yes, obviously a big part, and we had so many responses along these lines about the real Rob report back when you were in Seattle. How much were they as much fun to do as they were to watch?
Yeah, man, it was super fun, man. And for me, it was I would call Real Rob Report professional development. I mean, I did have a plan for the Real Rob Report, and I still kind of work on some things with it. But and you can see Players Tribune pretty much doing it now. Mm-hmm. That was kind of my idea first. But I wanted to get all of my bad, you know, commentating, all of my bad analysis, all the mess ups, all the, you know, kind of anxiety of being on a camera, knowing a lot of people are going to watch it and all of those types of things. I also took it as an opportunity to, you know, hone in on my editing. I also took it as an opportunity to script write and all of those things, to kind of learn everything about the broadcasting business kind of on my own, kind of grassroots. And I think it truly helped me in getting the job that I have today.
It's funny, obviously we come at from completely the other side, but almost when you say making your mistakes, for me as a fan watching it, seeing vulnerabilities and mistakes, like adding some human quality to what we look at as sports stars, I actually find that the most endearing part. And it often strikes me that sports stars, and I'm sure they know and they do a lot of stuff, but if all of them realized how much fans sort of enjoy seeing these guys as human beings as well as sports stars, you almost get a pass in terms of performance, like, because when you're rooting for the guy, I think it always makes it a bit easier to stomach when things don't go well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that's when it goes back to kind of Marshawn and what we talked about earlier, that freedom, when you kind of beat to the tune of your own drum, and you have that freedom to just, you know, think of things, do your own thing. I think it's liberating. And I think that's why guys like him, you know, you got some other guys out there that kind of express themselves in their own unique way. That's why they're popular. That's why they're able to make money off of that particular persona.
Yeah. So, as I said a few minutes ago, you have been back to VMAC this summer. And if anyone hasn't seen it, I think it's on YouTube. It's a really cool piece on the Seahawks. Obviously, a lot of big names, a lot of big loud voices, a lot of big personalities have left that building. Was it a noticeable difference this year around when you walked in that building, and have you seen people like Doug Baldwin and Bobby Wagner step into that breach when you were there?
Well, I think those guys have always been there. I mean, especially since I've left.
Yeah.
But it was a little quieter in there. You don't have the Michael Bennett, you don't have the Richard Shermans, you don't have some of the more vocal leaders that this team has enjoyed the last 4 or 5 years. And so it is a little different, but it's the same message coming from the same head coach with the same leader at quarterback. And they have that leader in the back end, and Earl Thomas, if they can get him in the camp or get him paid. But there is some similarity, but it is some differences. I think it's going to be a little bit of a struggle for them this year, quite frankly. But they're built right from a foundation standpoint. So it's one of those things where they could win 7 games. Or they could win 11 games based on 5 or 6 plays made or not made throughout the season.
Yeah. You just mentioned that Earl Thomas is obviously split in a lot of fans, a lot of people. As an ex-player, is that something that you can see from both, understand more on this side, or can you see from both sides of the business side of it and the personal side of it?
I mean, you obviously see it from both sides. Yeah. That's the... I mean, you do, because I mean, that's always been the knock against completely, you know, when I say completely guaranteed contracts, I'm not talking about the Kirk Cousins completely guaranteed contracts. I'm talking about if you're a third rounder, you know, and you're on your, you know, role player and you got a year or two deal, you know, just like a regular deal, which is enough, which is more than the average person around the world. But it's peanuts in the National Football League. What if that kid on the second year of their contract, they're only supposed to make $2 million, but it's a receiver and they lead the league in receiving, and, you know, in touchdowns. Well, that guy completely outperformed that contract. You know what I'm saying? So I do see both sides. But what Earl is going through right now, a lot of players go through. I mean, I went through it almost every year of my career, with the exception of my rookie year. The team you're playing without any guarantees. You're playing without much security other than the security you have and your abilities. But the thing I can say about Earl is he does give his all. He has given that organization 1,000%. And he does probably deserve a little bump in pay.
Yeah, Adam?
I find the situation a little bit difficult for both sides because you've obviously got there's no one really in the deal that seems to have that much leverage because ultimately people can say, oh, the team can do this and do that with the tag or whatever. But that having that noise around the locker room and everyone talking about it all day, that can't be helpful for the organization as much as it's not great for Thomas not being paid and playing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you don't want that noise around the locker room. But at the end of the day, if he goes, first of all, Earl has sustained a couple of injuries here late in his career. And I think he's thinking about, hey, I mean, Richard Sherman was just covering a normal dig route and blew out his Achilles.
Yeah.
You know, normal tackle that we've seen him make 1,000 times and boom, career's over. Cliff Avril, boom, career over. Yeah. I think a lot of things have happened to Earl here lately that has him thinking on a different vibe than he was when he was a younger player. And I think he's just looking for some security.
Yeah, we certainly hope that gets resolved because obviously one of the big things that we've got that's incredibly exciting for us is that the Seahawks are playing in London on October the 14th.
Yes.
As a player, I can imagine they could probably do without the trip, but as fans, I'm sure you can understand we're incredibly looking forward to seeing them all over here.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, the game of football is spreading into a worldwide entity. I mean, it's definitely one of the biggest sports, or if not the biggest sport in America, but... I'm involved in youth football. I'm always about, is the game being taught right? I think, you know, there are numbers that are out and numbers can be skewed in a lot of different ways, but I don't view the game as having a concussion problem. It's having a bad coaching problem, especially on the lower levels. Yeah. And when players get bad habits, they get hurt. And that's just the reality of our game.
That's funny because in soccer they say that if you don't go into a tackle 100%, you're more likely to get hurt, which I guess is similar if you don't do something full committed with the right technique in American football as well, I guess.
Yeah, and it's really got to be with the right technique. I mean, and I hate to talk about it because of what happened to him because it was terrible. And I always send prayers and great energy his way. But the Ryan Shazier hit, I mean. Wow. I mean, that was an eye opener. But the kid, you know, that was not a great way to tackle anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, it was with the net head down and the neck absorbed everything. And so that's just an example. We see it hundreds of times on Sunday and Saturdays too in college and all through high school and all through all the ranks. But it's because we have a lot of Madden coaches, for lack of better words, especially in the lower levels, teaching our kids. And these kids are developing bad habits and taking it with them through high school and college and so on.
So just to stick on this for one more thing, I've never played, so I have no experience what it's like to run with the helmet and the pads. But when I was in America, I put a helmet on and I was actually amazed as to how heavy they are and how tough they are. Do you think almost that in the first few years, these guys could do without playing with helmets at all to learn the right way to tackle and then they can progress into that level? Or because the helmet is what seems to be the biggest issue for me as someone that's never played.
The journal said it a long time ago. Said, guys, if you want to really protect these guys, take the face mask and the helmet off.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to protect them, take the face mask and the helmet off. My presidents in my youth football league, they didn't vote on it this year. But I want to have it only one hard helmet practice a week. Most of your concussions and most of your bad injuries happen in practice.
Mm-hmm.
So I would rather have, yeah, you can have your equipment on, but have soft shell helmets. I guarantee you kids won't go in head first with soft shell helmets on and no face masks. And you have colleges and some pro teams operating that way now because, as you can see, the rules with this helmet rule and all of those types of things, the game is changing.
Yeah. So obviously you're a bit pushed on, so we're going to try and rush through. We've got a couple of questions from our listeners. One that cropped up a few times was: is there any one player you wish you could relive or that sticks in your mind during your NFL or college career?
No. Well, the way everything's happened is supposed to happen. That's how I've always felt.
Yeah.
And I was supposed to learn all the lessons I was supposed to learn. So,
yeah. Yeah, I'm not all good. Not, not, ch- not change it, though, relive it. If you got the chance to just go through that buzz of play again.
To relive it? Not necessarily one play, but probably all of overtime in the Orange Bowl game that we won my last year. Just the drama, the missed kicks, the missed opportunities, the times we took advantage of opportunities. We stayed up till 1 o'clock in the morning, playing the actual game, you know, so that was fun. That was something I will never, ever forget. I was the most sore that I had ever been in my entire life. Still to this day, the day after that game was the most sore I had ever been in my life. Shout out to Bobby Bowden in Florida State. But yeah, all of overtime, brother. All of overtime.
Were there more tears then or at the end of the championship game against San Francisco?
Oh, probably into the championship game. I mean, you got to think, man. Yeah. Going to a Super Bowl, bro, like, that's like...
I was crying. Yeah. It was 4 in the morning. I was crying. Don't worry about me.
I mean, I'm watching these little kids out here right now practice. And, I mean, if you ask any of them that are some of the real serious football players, they're going to all say, I want to win a Super Bowl one day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what they're going to say.
You know? So, if the Super Bowl 48, obviously, we all have different experiences with Silo Pond and obviously in Seattle. What was it like to play in the game, which was over so early, really, after Percy Harvin's kick return?
It was awesome, man. I didn't get many snaps because, you know, we didn't really punt too much. We didn't have many kickoff returns. We had a lot of kickoffs, but they went out of the end zone.
Yeah.
I mean, we ran the ball some, but we just, you know, to me, that was another one of Russell Wilson's. I mean, he damn near went perfect that game.
Yeah.
You know, had a catch.
I had one early, you know, a little check down, and you know, every time a quarterback steps up in the pocket, and you're a running back, you're getting the ball, brother. It was all good, man. It was fun to play in that game. Fun to have my family come out. It was on the East Coast. I'm an East Coast guy, so a lot of family and friends were able to catch it and come up to New York.
Were you noticeably more nervous that day than any other game?
No, we knew we were going to win. I remember watching a film on Denver. Probably the Tuesday or Wednesday, me and Beast, we were in a film room. We were watching it probably the Tuesday or Wednesday right after we had beat San Francisco. And literally, we watched one quarter of one of their games. And we said, oh, man, this shit going to be easy. Did I say that out loud? My bad. I didn't mean to curse. Yeah.
Don't worry. No one listens to this show. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, so, he said, man, it's going to be easy, bro.
One other thing, just quickly back on your visit to VMAG a few weeks ago. Who won the pickup game, you or Pete Carroll?
Oh, actually, you know I beat Pete Carroll. Anybody that got shoes like that and that old, I'm going to talk to him. You know what I'm saying? Even though Pete do got a little shot, though.
You see so often on Twitter during training camp when you start chucking the ball around. Do you have to, like, remind yourself that Pete Carroll is a 66-year-old man doing what he does at the energy levels he does it at?
Excuse me, say that again?
When you see Pete Carroll doing what he was doing with you on the basketball court and sort of chucking the ball around before practice, is there any... Do you have to, like, remind yourself as a player or in your role now that this is a 66-year-old man doing this at this level for so long?
Oh, man, well, I mean, you got to think, man. Joe was 235 years old. He still was getting around. The game of football, and you're around young people, it's a young man's sport. The game of football, the nature of it keeps you young. I mean, obviously, as a coach, you can stress yourself out, but that's the stresses you put on yourself. You can't allow the game to put the stresses on you. You got to take it for what it is. It is a game, and you're supposed to have fun playing the game. And that's one thing I really took from Pete. He's really all about having fun, letting players have fun, letting players be themselves. And that's why it was fun coming to work. When I was with San Francisco, I know it's probably different there now, but when I was with San Francisco early in my career, we were losing, and it just wasn't fun to go to work.
Adam, anything?
So are we going to see you in London on October for the Seahawks game, or are you not going to make the trip over?
I have no idea. I'm with the network. They may tell me maybe the week or so before. That's kind of how we do things at the network. But I don't know. We'll see, brother. But if I come over, expect me on your podcast again.
Yeah,
you better be.
An open invite. When we posted on all our social medias that you were lucky enough to be having you on our podcast, the most common thing was how much you are missed in Seattle, you are missed on the field, and how much they appreciated all your effort as a Seahawks. So I think I'd be doing our listeners a disservice if I didn't pass the message on. We do appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, brother.
Is there anything you want? Where can people catch up with you? Obviously, the NFL Network.
On social media and stuff. Yeah, NFL Network. My shows are Good Morning Football Weekend on Saturdays and Sundays, early in the morning on the East Coast. Obviously, all my social media is Real Mike Rob. You can check me out on all of them. I usually do a Facebook Live on Thursdays. I do Periscope Live throughout the season. Check me out. Give me a follow. Instagram, Real Mike Rob also. Give me a follow, man, and get all the latest stuff.
Yeah.
When are we getting a return for the R&B podcast?
Man, you know, Nate doing his thing. You know, I'm doing my thing. You know, it's just...
That was a good show.
Up.
I liked it.
They broke us up. Well, trust me, man. I had so many more ideas for that show. But, you know, I wanted it to be more than a podcast. I wanted it to be a show, you know, where we actually get into some stuff. But I don't know. We'll see.
Well, yeah. It sounds like you both have to come to London and we'll do the first relaunch on our London podcast. It sounds like
there you go. Let's get it.
Yeah. And also, do you want to plug the Youth League as well? If you want to.
Yeah, man, my youth football league, E2E, it's Excel to Excellence Youth Football League. You can check it out on the website, e2efootball.org. Again, we talk about football a little differently. We don't talk about football in terms of genetics, meaning we don't talk about football in terms of how fast you run, how hard you hit, how far you can throw a football, all of those things. When you talk about football that way, the powers that be across the world think that football is too violent. Totally overlooking the fact that the brain processes that a quarterback or a middle linebacker or some of these cornerbacks, or linemen, any position, some of the brain processes that these guys are doing are totally phenomenal, and they're doing some of the same things that people at Google and Amazon, all of these people that make six figures for the next 30 years, we're doing it on the football field in front of millions of people. With live bullets, so to speak, not real bullets, but you know, football players flying at you.
Yeah. Awesome. As I keep saying, massively do appreciate you taking the time. Hopefully there will be another time, but until now, thank you very much, Michael.
Thanks, guys. Y'all be good.
Yep. Thanks so much, man. We really appreciate it.
Second and four. Again, time. Near side, intercepted. It's intercepted by Chancellor. Touchdown.
Yeah, that was just a lot of fun. Obviously, as I said, Michael Robinson, the first thing he said to me when he connected was, "I've only got 10 minutes, guys," and obviously half an hour later. But it was really interesting. It was just quite cool to talk to him, wasn't it, for half an hour of them?
It was great. And he, if I'm not mistaken, quote-unquote, wants to be back on in the future in London and bring Marshawn Lynch on it. Yeah. So I think in the terms of the Virgin Media advert with Wycliffe Jean, I think you'll find that's legally binding.
That's the main thing I took from it. Not that anything groundbreaking, it was just the fact that we were going to get Marshawn Lynch on this podcast in the near future. I think that's the only thing.
Absolutely.
Kind of clouded everything. But yeah, massive, massive thanks to Michael for jumping on and spending even half an hour, even 10 minutes would have been fine, because he does have a ridiculously busy schedule flying from West Coast for NFL Network, East Coast for all his football camp, and then when he jumps on Good Morning Football as well from Times Square, it is a ludicrously busy schedule that man has. So we massively appreciate it, and a massive thanks to his people, his PA, for helping sort that out. We were meant to podcast a few days ago, but modern technology is out of doing that. So when we were going to podcast, we asked for some of your questions, so we're going to get to some of them now before we move on to Get in the Bin, Adam, which I'm pretty certain you're looking forward to more than anything else.
I'm sweating with anticipation.
So yeah, someone called Ross Bell, do you know who that is?
Rings a bell,
yeah,
but I can't place it.
Once Tanner McAvoy gets cut, I forgot he was a thing, who should he choose to be his next favourite underdog Seahawk who ultimately will be cut? And as I responded, there will be plenty to choose from, but who's someone that Ross should latch onto in the Tanner McAvoy Cassius Marsh stakes, Adam?
I mean, he does love someone that is absolutely useless. I was going to say Brandon Marshall, but I think he might stick around for longer than we thought, although I'm not whether he's going to be good or not, I don't know. Yeah. Who can we go with? That is a good question. I wonder if someone like Tedrick Thompson.
I think, yeah, that's who I thought.
Yeah, it could be Tedrick.
Yeah, because he's probably going to be terrible, because we're going to give like 40-yard pass touchdowns this year, but Ross will enjoy his hair or something.
Yeah, I think as Danny O'Neill and Ben Baldwin pointed out, whenever the Seahawks absolutely laud a guy replacing a guy holding out, you know he's generally going to be rubbish. And Tedrick's getting the treatment right now about you know, being a great playmaker in the Deion Bailey mold from 3 years ago. So
Who else was it at the safety position? Deion Bailey. Oh crap! Who else was it? There's another one who did. Oh, Stephen Terrell.
Stephen Terrell, yeah. Deion Bailey was one that fell at the last minute against the Rams, take it to overtime, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, they won, in week one. And weirdly, Cam Chancellor reappeared on 2 days later. Sean Wilson asked, what position group do we expect to have more clarity around roster spots during the preseason games? You mentioned Brandon Marshall. We said last time we podcasted he's probably not made the team. It appears even with doing very little against the Colts last week, that he's probably ascended the depth chart, or maybe didn't, ascended his chances have increased quite mightily. Wide receiver group could be the one, couldn't it? Or is anywhere else for you?
I think the offensive line, you pretty much know who's going to be sort of first team, second team. And I wonder if the secondary is going to start working itself out fairly quickly. But I don't know. I mean, if we were to, off the top of your head, pick a 53, in terms of absolute locks, there's probably only about 30 on there right now.
I mean, obviously, you know, QB1, RB1, RB2, three wide receivers. You probably know the tight ends more than anything else.
Yeah.
Because I think that's the three is almost set. Tyron Smoot, so I really wanted to see something from him. I don't think I've seen his name once. I don't think you played last week either. So I think tight end, that's a pretty small group. But yeah, I think, 30 probably sounds about right. means the corner opposite Shaquille Griffin seems to be a massive question mark, since obviously that's going to happen when you allow someone like Richard Sherman to walk out of the building for absolutely nothing. I can't believe
it's going to be Byron Maxwell. And I love Byron Maxwell. He was probably in my top 10 favourite players from the Super Bowl 48-49 era.
Yeah.
I love Byron Maxwell. I mean, his game in Philadelphia against Mark Sanchez is one of my favourite ever performances from a Seahawks player.
Yeah.
But it can't be him, can it?
I think it's going to be Trey Flowers. I really think it's going to be Trey Flowers after last week.
He's going to play right corner.
Yeah, I think he's been with the ones last couple of days in practice as well. I think Maxwell has practiced today for the first time in about 10 days as well. I can see what's coming back. Obviously, he's learning as he goes, and like we said, Rashard Penny needing the three hits in preseason. He needs the three hits in preseason, and hopefully, as Brock Hewer kept saying, he has a lot of learning tape from this. He wasn't really torched, but he was giving up a lot of plays that Shaquille Griffin was giving up last year, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't getting beat long, but he was getting beat in like 4 to 8 yards. On 3rd and 7, so it's kind of, and he was a bit handsy as well at times. But I do think it'll be Trey Flowers again opposite Shaquille Griffin in week one against Day Thomas and Emmanuel Sanders. Is he still in Denver?
He's still there.
Yeah. Sean Wilson also asked, which of the new coaches do you believe will enhance their reputation on this team with the players they have at their disposal? I mean, everyone said since he became the offensive coordinator, Schottenheimer has never had a quarterback like Russell Wilson, so it's probably going to be him, isn't it?
Yeah, although he had a weird comment. Did you see that about the 53 thing?
Yeah, I didn't understand that.
So what he was saying was that when he has a game plan, he wants the pass completions plus the runs to equal 53 in a game. And if you get to 53, you win. I don't know how they work that out or what maths goes into it, but there are a few people that sort of agree with it, but it just seems very strange. What do you do once you get past 53? You just kneel the game out? I mean, what if it's been like an offensive masterclass and it's still the third quarter? So I don't really understand what that is. And it worries me that he's a little bit... I mean, the visor worries me, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
I mean, Ian Poulter and Brian Schottenheimer are the only two people I can place wear a visor. And they're both absolute disasters.
Well, the thing...
That does worry me.
The thing is obviously we've heard us for like to ad nauseum, you don't win things in the fourth quarter. If you look at Ian Poulter's 2018 season, if golf tournaments ended on Saturday afternoons, he'd win a lot. But they well,
it
don't.
Did worry me that he once tweeted out that Sunday is apparently a rest day for him. Which, if you know anything about golf, that shouldn't be what you're saying.
Yeah, so the fact that he said that, and then obviously compared to Brighton, Charlton, Armour, maybe we won't win games in the fourth quarter this year, which is probably likely. Yeah, I think like we said with Pete Carroll's random word of the day, I think maybe 53 was just the number of the day. And he just kind of, maybe he was bored and just counting sheep, and that's the number he got to when the question come up.
It just seems like one of those things that, like, you're trying to sound overly intelligent and actually just sound like a bit of a dolt.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you're trying to be PFF when you're PFFFFFFF.
Yeah, very much so.
Your mouth. Jonathan Rose also asks, with the absence of ET, who is our next best option on the roster? It's basically lie down in the ball and cry, isn't it?
Sorry, I missed the player that we missed out. If who's missing, who's the next best option?
Earl Thomas.
Ugh, I mean, it's going to be a... it's a shit show either way if Earl Thomas isn't there, let's be honest.
Yeah, it's medium back. And yeah, as I said, Ross's new favourite, Tajik Thompson, might not have a fun ride. John Maxfield wants to know... would like to know what we're interested in seeing from position groups beyond obvious things like the O-line and the draft of rookies. Himself is looking forward to seeing what Keenan Reynolds can do. I just kind of want to see what we have everywhere. Is that
yeah? I mean,
too broad.
I find it really hard to put any stock in the preseason at all. For me, it's all about Denver. I'm on to Cincinnati right now. Just don't get hurt and take us to Denver and see. You know, Denver are pretty bollocks, let's be honest.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be a measure of where we are, how that game gets dealt with. If we win, I'll be very pleasantly surprised and hopeful for the future of the season.
Yeah.
But if, you know, I think it all comes down to how we play in Mile High Stadium.
Yeah, I'll agree. Mark Woodcock wants to know, obviously, referring to a story which I can't remember, USA Today maybe did it, when about you predicted all the schedule and all the end of season records, which obviously means very little. That he says some people are saying that the Seahawks are a 4 or 5 win team this season, and if that's reasonable for the Seahawks. Obviously, everyone lost their collective villa when that broke. It's probably the baseline, isn't it? It's like the floor of this team rather than the floor. Well,
We tried to do a live podcast pre-draft that I don't think ever dropped, and we went through the games, and I had us at 6-10.
Yeah.
That's probably on the negative side, but ultimately, there's not a lot of difference between 6-10 and 10-6, as last season, if any, showed. I mean, you know, 6-10, 10-6, maybe could be 5 plays that go your way. So I worry, but in my opinion, you know, we used to have the star power to turn losses into wins, and I think that could be the thing that we're most lacking, as much as anything else, having, you know, the star that can make the huge interception or the huge grab or the massive run or the big block. We probably don't have that massive star quality that can do that, and so that's the worry for me, that's why I see close games going away from us instead of you know, being able to grab a victory from the jaws of defeat.
I think 5, 6, 7 is what we're going to see from the Seahawks this year for the reasons you've just listed. Yeah, massive thanks to everyone for sending their questions. Probably more, but I can't find the other post because, as I said, it was about a week ago at this point. We're going to try and keep doing that all through the season. We're going to try and maybe set up an entire segment, which means I can edit more stupid bits of production together. But now, Adam, it's time for this week's Get in the Bin.
First of all, this is an exciting time for our organization.
2017 Browns joined the 2008 Lions as the only teams to go 0-16.
Get in the bin.
Give me Josh Freeman, who was the 17th pick in the first round, over Cam Newton, who was the number one overall pick.
And the 2015 AP Most Valuable Player is Cam Newton.
Get in the bin.
Chip Kelly is an evolver, and he's a smart guy, and I think he's going to go to San Francisco and Mike, and they're going to be a much more viable football franchise.
That the 49ers are expected to clean house and dismiss head coach Chip Kelly.
Get in the bin.
Yeah, I think Adam's been looking forward to this for the last 36 to 48 hours or so. This week's getting a bin. It's, well, like I said, J.R. Sweezy, you should never go back. But sometimes when you do go back, you might as well hit all the classics, Adam.
Oh, Hugh. Hughie. I have to say, he was going in the bin for nonsense anyway.
Yeah.
But what I have just found on Pro Football Talk has entrenched him so deeply in the bin.
What's he said?
Hugh Jackson seems to lean towards Drew Stanton as Tyrod Taylor's backup.
No, he doesn't.
This is the quote. I've said from the beginning that I think experience is important. Right now, Drew still has that experience, and we'll see how all that unfolds as we go. I haven't made that choice just yet, but his veteran presence says a lot. He played in a lot of games against a lot of teams that we're going to start off against and play against, so I think that's important to definitely consider.
Mary Kay Cabau is one of the top beat writers for the Browns, said that Hugh Jackson said he will have a heck of a decision between Mayfield and Stanton if Tyrod goes down early in the Browns season. Oh boy. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy.
This guy is honestly just sapping all of the potential love out of one of the great stories that the season could cough up this year. I mean, he's just a complete hyena. And, oh my goodness, he is just so annoying.
But he also said 2 hours ago that... Oh no, he did say, yeah, I misread that tweet. Oh my days. And he, okay, so before that quote, what, 30 minutes ago come through, or 5 minutes ago, what other reasons is Hugh Jackson in the bin for this week, Adam?
Well, there was an interesting thing with a receiver that they were punishing, in inverted commas, by making him catch 30 balls from the pass machine, and then it flicked to Pittsburgh, where they say that Antonio Brown catches 120 passes voluntarily a day.
Yeah.
So a little bit of how the other half live.
But it's amazing. And also, the best thing is like the third or fourth thing you're going to get to.
And then you've got is it Antonio Callaway or yeah. Antonio Callahan?
Callaway,
the receiver who has been punished by he's got disciplinary issues, and to punish him, they're making him play a lot in the preseason. This is a guy that's probably been Baker Mayfield's number one receiver in preseason so far. And lo and behold, he's gotten himself injured.
Okay, it's the fourth thing you're going to get to, because on Monday, Browns head coach Hugh Jackson was asked about Jarvis Landry. If anyone's seen, what's the name of the show? Hard Knocks, the first episode.
Oh, God, I forgot about this.
Yeah, there's a video. I've already seen the clip. I haven't seen the full episode where he's Jarvis Landry exhorts his teammates and tells them that he needs to practice hard and all that comes with it. How that will pay off. Hugh Jackson's response was, and remember, this is the Cleveland Browns head coach, he said, he is a new guy here too. He's working through it. He is learning what we are about.
Well, you're about 0-16, mate.
And there was another quote, but I can't find it. I think also, talking about Cleveland Browns, there is also the amazing promotion they've got with Bud Light, where Bud Light yesterday announced the release of the Bud Light Cleveland Browns Victory Fridge. Apparently this is completely legit, that the fridge will automatically unlock after the Browns capture their first regular season victory of the 2018 NFL season. I mean, Bud Light's not the greatest beer, it's the worst beer, but it's not nice when it's fresh. I mean, what's it going to be when it's like 6 months old?
It's probably not going to be the best, is it?
No. I mean, he's just the best. I mean, he's literally given us... But there's probably more things. We're not even talking about Hugh Jackson. He is just the best for all the wrong reasons. My turn. Jerry Jones, Dallas Cowboys. All the stuff about no Dallas Cowboy is going to be allowed to protest the anthem and all that nonsense. Obviously, there's an amazing mural. I'm guessing it's somewhere in Texas or somewhere in Dallas where someone's painted Dak Prescott and he looks like... the guy in Get Out when he's in the sunken place, which is just the greatest thing. If anyone's seen Get Out, it's amazing. It's just so spot on. And obviously then Jerry Jones was videoed during the national anthem being told that he still had his hat on and then not taking the hat off. I mean, he is the mouthpiece of the president in the NFL, isn't he, Jerry?
Yeah, and you know, another one who can get in the bin is the president himself. What he seems to fail to realize is that the protest is not against the anthem.
No.
It occurs whilst the anthem is going on.
Yeah, it's just juxtaposed against it.
And if it meant that much to everyone, which I'm sure it means a lot to everyone, but if it meant that much to everyone, they wouldn't allow you to film the players during it, because the cameraman would also have to be standing up and observing the anthem as well. So this sort of one rule for one and one rule from the other is becoming such a nonsense, and ultimately so boring.
Yeah, it's the message is completely lost. Doug Baldwin last week, while he didn't play, did wear a shirt highlighting the figures for how many black Americans are incarcerated in American prisons. I think Dwayne Brown and a couple of others, Quentin Jefferson, I think, a couple of those Seahawks did not take the field as is their free choice, apparently free choice, to do before game, and they come out after the anthem last week. It's going to be a thing, it's going to continue to rumble, and the only thing, the only organisation that's going to come out looking the worst for it is the NFL. Any other stuff going on? Any other NFL stuff outside of Hugh Jackson? Or have you just been transfixed by his nonsense this week, Adam?
I think that's about where I am, to be honest. You got anything else that we've missed?
I don't believe so. Also, one other thing before we get in the bin. The Major League Baseball traditionalists. I don't know what his name is, but the Dodgers won a game a few nights ago.
Oh, this is amazing.
With a Grand Slam home run when they were down by 3. I think it's extra innings as well. A 25-year-old... I don't know what position he plays. He 25 swung on and belted, as Dave Niehaus once used to say for the Mariners. He swung on and belted and cleared the fences, cleared the bases, won the game for the LA Dodgers, and he had the gall to do a bat flip, and he had to apologise. He had to apologise for flipping a bat. I mean, I know sports, and obviously we see it quite a bit in this country with certain sports and how they have etiquette and on-field and off-field and all the other nonsense that goes on from people who've been watching the sport for too long and can't keep up with a changing face of a sport. But come on, man. He's someone who's worked his 20 years of his life to get to where he did. And in a big moment, although the Dodgers have lost every game since, in a big moment like that, when the Dodgers are in a pretty tight divisional race, come on, just let him have that. I mean, get out. It's a case of get out your own way, really, isn't it? Just, I mean, no. Everyone seems, okay, fair enough, you apologise, not... No, there's no need to apologise. It's just a nonsense.
To double down on Dodgers' nonsense, their commentary duo about 2 weeks ago were lambasting their players for daring to do batting practice in shorts and T-shirts as opposed to official Dodgers gear.
I saw that.
Yeah. And saying that ex-Dodgers would be, quote-unquote, turning in their graves if they ever saw such a thing.
Yeah, I saw that. Oh, baseball. Yeah, I mean, the NFL's not far behind. I think the only...
Baseball, get in the bin.
Yeah, the whole sport. Exactly.
Plenty of space.
Yep. Just get out of the bin if the Mariners make the playoffs, which Dee Gordon has done a lot to help tonight. Obviously, London is 7-8 weeks away now. There is still loads of stuff happening. Hopefully, things will be announced in the next few days, a few weeks. Obviously, everything building up to the game on the Sunday, but the night before at Leadenhall Revolution in the city. It's in the centre of the city, isn't it, Adam? Leadenhall Revolution?
I've never been, but no. I think it is pretty central, yeah.
Yeah, obviously the first wave of tickets have all sold out, but there is a wait list up on the Facebook group and somewhere on the Twitter page. If you just sign up for that, once we hit a certain number of things, they will hopefully be released. If not, you will be refunded, I think. I'm not too sure how that all works. Probably should have checked up on that before I started speaking. Hopefully it will be an amazing night. 450 people have already bought tickets, so yeah, it should be quite a meet. I think the most we had at a meet before was like 64, so it should be a pretty good night. Obviously, we, as I said, more stuff will come out, and more we will announce people who hopefully will be able to get there. And obviously, a big part of that is going to be raising money for charities. Obviously, Archie Smile, the SSAFA, and all the stuff on its way from somewhere in America, from Kim and the Helinski family, which is probably going to piss off my postman in the next few days. All that, obviously, chip in and dive into your pocket. Dive into deep into your pockets to help out an amazing cause, and three amazing causes. do that at Leadenhall Revolution on Saturday, 13th October in London. Yeah, this, if you want to follow the podcast, you can on Twitter via at SeahawkersUK. That's all you can get all the info for all the other meat stuff and everything else that goes on in the chapter next few weeks. You can follow me, Adam, on Twitter at Stu_Court, at Adam D. Nathan. The Facebook page for the group and the chapter is at UK Seahawks, at UK Seattle Seahawks fans. The podcast is on the podbean.com, perpetualpodcast.podbean.com. Yeah, we're back in a week or so talking about probably a lot of nothing. We're going to keep trying to get guests on. Might even see if Michael Sean Dugar is available and free and willing to come on and talk about what he's seen at training camp this week. If you haven't read any of his stuff or you haven't subscribed yet, do go and subscribe to The Athletic, which is where Michael does all his writing nowadays. It's just the best. It's every day. It just churns out really top-notch articles and content. But yeah, I think that's everything, Adam.
Think we're good.
Yeah, so until next time, this has been the Possession Podcast. Sign us out this week. This is Bobby Wagner talking about taking over the leadership role on the Seahawks. Miles Bennett and Shum.
I feel like that's more of the outside. You know, I feel like it's always been, you know, it starts up front, you know, with us. You know, you got to get the plays, you got to get the call. Yeah, they had the name and, you know, they got a lot of the attention, and now the attention may shift to the linebackers. But, you know, we pride ourselves on being the guys that lead this team. And so that's been my mindset since I stepped here and, you know, had Coach Norton teach me the way. And, you know, it's always been about the guy in the middle. So for me, it's not no different because that's how I looked at it. But from the outside, maybe it is different because those guys are gone and, you know, you guys are looking for someone who's going to be that leader. Y'all ain't got to look. Like, y'all looking at the guy right here. I will be that guy and, you know, we're going to be fine. You create the nickname around with. If you got a nickname, it's fire. We run with it. We have your name in fine print, real small. We'll take the credit, but real small print. And if you got a magnifying glass, you'll see it.
Going to do it. 12s, they're bringing the trophy home. Your Seahawks, Super Bowl 48 champions.